Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And happy Labor Day. I mean, there's a lot of times I forget to mention, since the day is Labor Day and we're recording this, but we actually have live, or I should say fresh content. This is fresh content, folks. And we always try to give you fresh content. I never take holidays off. As a matter of fact, this is one holiday that I'm absolutely ashamed that America is involved in this holiday. And so this is because most people do not know the history of Labor Day. And that's because most people do not know how America was slowly penetrated. So when we look at the globalist plan, when we look at communism, and we'll do this, we'll take, as a matter of fact, I may actually take time on Friday to do Billy Graham's commitment letter, the letter of commitment, because I usually do that once a year, and I don't think I've done it this year, because we've just been covering a lot of different content. So anyway, and forgive me, with my daily struggles, I always have something going on with my throat and lungs and so forth. But anyway, I don't want people to be concerned. I feel like I'm doing better. I remember prior to being diagnosed, I was just lethargic all the time. It was a struggle to even do shows. I mean, if you listen to my shows prior, I mean, you may not notice, but I had to sleep. I mean, I had to do everything I could to, you know, pump a bunch of caffeine into me just to have some energy. And, you know, that's just your normal. You just feel like you're completely burned out. And anyway, so I'm feeling much better these days since I'm finally getting oxygen and those types of things. So what about Labor Day? Well, you know, I'm going to get into Labor Day, and I'm going to get into the history, but actually I'm going to tie this to the previous assertions I've been making. And I've been saying this for a long time, that there are certain people that should not be allowed to be citizens in America. When you've crossed that line to where you become an ideologue for communism, where you become an ideologue for subjugation of any kind. And see, I don't think I think the framers kind of understood it, but I don't think, you know, they recognized how corruption, or at least at that point in time, they were so like-minded. As John Jay said, go read Federalist Paper number 2. He basically says we are a like society. We all basically came from, you know, the same parts of England. You know, we all basically are Christian. You know, we are so much alike. Well, America wasn't designed to be homogeneous. America was designed to be heterogeneous. And as a matter of fact, the world was designed to, you know, actually create all, because, you know, as different races intermix, we create different varieties. I mean, today it is Muttville throughout the world. I hear people all the time talking about, and I do not recommend you sending your DNA in, but I hear people all the time talking about their outcome of their DNA. How they've got Italian, German, you know, Chinese, and, you know, an African. And I mean, what parts of the world, you know, do you not have in some of these cases? And it's becoming more and more common to finding that. And as we become more global, that's what we're going to find, is we're actually creating, because technically, when you look at a person and you say, well, that person's English, not anymore. not anymore, because there's been so many different races that have become a part of England or become a part of America that we're spawning new races and or new, you know, mixes, different forms of, I mean, you can't just use the term mulatto anymore. And so is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? Well, in my opinion, I honestly think that's probably a good thing, because one of the things we realize is when you got stuck into a gene pool, it caused problems. All of a sudden, we start realizing that you're predisposed to these certain conditions, certain health problems, and so forth. What really, you know, we're finding today is the majority of all of our health problems, and I'm actually going to cross this line for the first time, that the majority of most of our health problems are coming from not just, you know, the environment, but actually what the globalists, what those maniacal people have been injecting into and changing our food supply so that we would actually be formed or moved to be formed to support their model moving forward to where they're making money off of us, as well as they're getting the outcome, the feminizing of our cultures, the feminizing of the world. What's so funny is you hear all of these different, you know, countries and cultures where they say, oh, well, that's not happening. Well, actually, it is. It's happening everywhere. And, you know, the evil science is being embraced by the globalists. So we're exposing a lot of this in the medical freedom petition, so you're really going to want to read that. But let me get back to this concept of how, you know, I've made these really radical comments that once you've crossed the line where you're no longer capable, if you're not capable of standing up for the Constitution, folks, there's lots of people there. There are a lot of people in that square. That's a big box. Because there are lots of people, whether it's for religious purposes or anything else, they are not capable of supporting the Constitution. So what do we do? Well, we can allow them to go move to these other countries that are not necessarily a constitutional republic, and you know, they can be supporting or not supporting the government and see how that works for them. Because 9 times out of 10, people don't realize what they're missing or what they have until it's gone. And there's a song about that, but there is some truth when we really start looking at, you know, putting it into different analogies. How many times have we heard where somebody, you know, a couple, you know, kind of falls out of love after being married for a while, and then all of a sudden either they both or one partner says, you know, I just don't have the same feelings anymore, and they leave, and it's only after they leave they start realizing what they're missing and how they really did love that person and how much that person meant and what they were failing to see. And how things may have changed because of them or what have you. And, you know, and they either have the opportunity to get remarried or they go the rest of their life realizing that they screwed it up. And so, you know, I pity anybody that goes through that. I mean, going through divorce is tough enough. But to recognize that you did something, I mean, we all have our own regrets, but you know, when we actually go through the deductive process and make a decision that actually puts us on the wrong path for the rest of our lives, boy, that is a tough road to hoe. And so, I mean, I have my plenty of my own faults, but fortunately, I didn't have to take that one. I didn't go down that road. So today's Labor Day, and today is where we celebrate a day off. We actually get paid to doing nothing. Now, that's a very dangerous paradigm. It's a dangerous concept to, you know, go into this, you know, this mind model that the employer, you go get a job and the employer is basically being held hostage or being coerced into saying, you hire somebody, you have to give them a day off with pay. Now, there's lots of small businesses that can't do that. And if they're small enough, they're not forced to do that. But once you get to a certain size, once you become so successful, then now you have to. And it's not a good deal. And so what we want to do today, what I'm going to do today, is I'm actually going to give you the insights, because this all falls under the ends justify the means, because that is an evil paradigm. And so I'm going to give you the insights for the fanfare for the common man. Now, what is that? What is fanfare for the common man? That's actually the song that we play, and it's the bumper music. All my bumper music, any music that you hear on this, unless I tell you something different, we start the show off with this, and we end the show with this, and we go out to break with it, and we come back, you know, with little segments of fanfare for the common man. Now, this is, and so all of this information is extrapolated or literally copied out of Wikipedia. I'm going to tell you why I use it after I tell you how it was developed. Fanfare for the Common Man is a musical work by the American composer Aaron Copland, classical piece, orchestrated, what have you. And he actually inserted it into one of his, I believe, is a third movement of a symphony he wrote. It was written in response to the U.S. entry into World War II and was inspired in part by a famous 1942 speech where Vice President Henry Wallace proclaimed the dawning of the common man. And as a matter of fact, it was used by Wallace himself. And as a matter of fact, if you really look up Wallace and you go actually look into Wallace in Wikipedia, you'll actually find where he actually asked Copland to try to write a piece like that, to write a piece for him. And so... In other words, there's a little bit of incestual relationship here. It wasn't just written for or because of. This was all about programming. And so Copland considered several titles, including Fanfare for a Solemn Ceremony and Fanfare for Four Freedoms. Now, Four Freedoms were goals articulated by U.S. President FDR, or Franklin Delano Roosevelt, on Monday, January 6, 1941. In an address known as the Four Freedoms Speech, technically the 1941 State of the Union Address, he proposed, so folks, you want to go get a copy of his State of the Union Address so you can actually read it in its entirety, because he talks about freedoms. But actually, he's using that as the portal in telling you that this new global government is, you know, going to be better than the one we have. And so he starts off with, you know, that, the, you know, everywhere in the world ought to enjoy freedom of speech, freedom of worship, worship, not religion, worship, freedom from want, freedom from fear. In context, now, again, I'm just reading this out of, and how I've cut and pasted this, you know, kind of together out of Wikipedia. In context, he summarized the values of democracy behind the bipartisan consensus on international involvement that existed at the time. A famous quote from the speech prefaces those values, quote, "As men do not live by bread alone, they do not fight by armaments alone." In the second half of the speech, he lists the benefits of democracy, not a Republican form of government, but a democracy, mob rule, which would include economic opportunity, employment, social security, and the promise of adequate health care, quote unquote. The first two freedoms of speech and religion are protected by the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. His inclusion of the latter two freedoms went beyond the traditional constitutional values protected by the U.S. Bill of Rights. In other words, Roosevelt endorsed a broader human right to economic security and anticipated what would become known decades later as human security. The paradigm in studies of economic development, he also included, quote, freedom from fear against national aggression and took it to the new United Nations he was setting up at that time. The majestic piece was designed to stir the American society to embrace global democracy and the governance of mankind under a new global government. So, Fanfare for the Common Man was designed to basically, as it was a prelude, you know, making you feel like this is something majestic. And nine times out of ten, when you hear this music play, Fanfare for the Common Man, it is usually to help inspire, you know, sports teams or what have you to ascend, to play the best that they possibly can. And so that was the whole point behind the music, was to get mankind to ascend to this new level of cooperation. And if you really want to read a great book, you have to read Fascism in America. It's by Jonas Greenberg, I believe. Actually, after the break, I will tell you exactly what the title is because it's in my recommended reading list, but I will tell you exactly. I think it's Totalitarianism in America. I don't know. Fascism in America. It has a smiley face. It's a red book with a big yellow smiley face on it. And yeah, it's Greenberg. I know that. But anyway, I wasn't planning on bringing this up. But he actually talks about FDR, Fanfare for the Common Man, and all this whole snow job that they were putting over on Americans. But folks, the reason why America and your grandparents at that time didn't reject it is because America was being transitioned decades and decades before into communism. Did you know that Labor Day was already being celebrated long before Franklin Delano Roosevelt? And so that's why I kind of set this up with helping you understand that the Fanfare for the Common Man was basically a piece to help manipulate people into feeling good about becoming a part of a collectivist society. And I believe, and I'm using it today, because technically the music is free. And so, because I'm not selling it, but I mean, I believe it's beyond copyrights today, because that was over 100 years ago, almost 100 years ago. And I think copyrights for music like that, especially those types of pieces, when they've been reorchestrated or what have you, it's just, I don't, you know what? And this, I have a problem with this, because the Constitution says the federal government should set copyrights, but for reasonable periods of time. I don't think that copyrights for music and those types of pieces should be that long. I mean, I don't believe that now that we're looking at the Beatles being, well over 50 years, right? I mean, we're getting into the 60 now, right? The 50th anniversary was last decade. And so when we look at music copyrights, I honestly think that it should be done so to where, you know, the artist, maybe the lifespan of the artist, but I still think that's too long. I still think that copyrights, because it's not necessarily about the music screwing the artist or screwing over the original thought. It's really when we look at the patents and copyrights of very important pieces of work that need to be, you know, utilized, not to help create an advantage for a company, because then they can dominate the world. It is to ensure that it can go forward, become profitable, and then allow the rest of the world to embrace that same technology and not allow one company to dominate. Because we've seen that, and or a couple companies to dominate. So anyway, Labor Day today, in the 1800s, more than 80 other countries celebrated what was called the International Workers' Day on May 1st. Now, you do the research and you'll figure out exactly how they played this down, but I want to focus on May Day. Now, I could spend 2-3 days on this, on Labor Day alone, the history of all of this. The European holiday of May Day was actually chosen by the Second International of Socialist and Communist Parties of all of these different nations to commemorate what? Get this, folks. To commemorate the general labor strike in the United States and events leading to the Haymarket Affair, which occurred in Chicago on May 1st, May 4th in 1886. Do you understand what I just told you? They were commemorating this terrible strike that killed people, commemorating, you know, this violent uprising in America because it imbued communism. Because who was celebrating this? This wasn't, you know, those people for freedom and liberty. It was the socialist and communist parties of 80 international nations. 80 international nations. Okay. Beginning in the late 19th century, as the trade union and labor movements grew, diverse groups of trade unionists chose a variety of days to celebrate labor. In the United States, a September holiday called Labor Day was first proposed in the early 1880s. Alternative accounts. So in other words, collectivism and union. So actually, let me back up. We know Marx wrote his books mid-1800s. When did unions come to America? Was it after Marx? No. In other words, I talked about Adam Weishaupt's plan, divisionism, and so forth, and I actually talked about Freemasonry and how Freemasonry didn't really get the full grasp of communism until, you know, everything was, you know, step by step was accepted, and they had to lay out, okay, they got to accept this before we can get them to accept this. We got to get them to accept this before they'll accept this, and so forth. So they laid out the dominoes that they needed to get society to buy into. And collective labor was one of those principles. Unionism and communalism were the fundamental principles, because that's what they used in France for the French Revolution, was collective communalism, which was a form of a group of poor people that lived in a communal society so they could share and help each other. Very similar to how many, you know, I'll say millennia of the fundamentals of China, where, you know, some despot would decide, some emperor, god, or what have you, would decide, okay, these people need to be killed because we're getting low on food. Anyway, I mean, because China has always been submitting to that type of governance and that type of societal norm. Anyway, that was my third anyway. When we look at how things started coming to America, it was really the union first, this concept of unionized or collectivized labor, which was in the early 1800s. So these principles had to come in bit by bit. So even though Freemasonry, and even though some people may have understood the real mechanics behind this dark plan of the Illuminati, it was still very far and few between. We had to get so much, and it would grow by so, you know, it was very methodical. And so when we look at collectivism, well, hold on, how could communism and all of this stuff come out well before Marx? Actually, the guidebook for collectivism or statism came from Plato's Republic. Now, I'm going to get back to reading this about the alternative events and so forth, but we're going to get back into this after the break, because I've literally got, let's just 10 seconds left. And so we'll cover Labor Day, and then we'll cover the Seattle strike. Or actually, I won't cover the strike. I'll get into some of the details of another strike that you need to know about, because Jonah Goldberg or Greenberg, I'll have that name in the book right when we come back, but he actually talks about these things and how fascism and totalitarianism was, America was steeped in it by the turn of the century. When we went into the 20th century, it was done. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so I was not 100% correct. And guess what? It's always the names, right? So the name of the book, let me pull it over here so I don't have to twist away from it so you can hear me directly. The name of the book is Liberal Fascism, The Secret History of the American Left from Mussolini to the Politics of Meaning. Now, this is a book that was written a couple decades ago, and it was written by Jonah Goldberg. And so he actually will give you the insights of how long America had, you know, how long has it been since America really got to a point where we fully embrace socialism, even though many of you today would stand up and say, we are capitalist, we are free people, this is about liberty, we're a republican form of government. In almost every capacity, America has embraced socialism and communism. So this is why it's really, really important to go through the planks of communism. Because if we're embracing the planks of communism, then, folks, what's the difference, right? Now, when I get back into this Labor Day, alternative accounts of the events of the origins of Labor Day exist. Descendants of two men with similar last names claim their great-grandfather was the true father of the holiday. I really don't care. According to one early history of Labor Day, the event, or, you know, because both of these men or both of those families are claiming that they were a part of the downfall or a, you know, the subversion of our Constitution in America. Anyway, alternative accounts of the event's origin exist. According to one early history of Labor Day, the event originated in connection with a General Assembly of the Knights of Labor convened in New York City in September 1882. In connection with this clandestine Knights Assembly, a public parade of various labor organizations was held on September 5th under the auspices of the Central Labor Union of New York City. The popularity of the event spread across the country. In 1887, Oregon became the first state of the United States to make Labor Day an official public holiday. By 1894, 30 U.S. states were already officially celebrating. In other words, the majority of the states were already celebrating Labor Day. In that year, Congress passed a bill recognizing the first Monday of September as Labor Day and making it an official federal holiday. President Grover Cleveland signed the bill into law on the 28th of June. The federal law, however, only made it a holiday for federal workers. As late as the 1930s, unions were encouraging workers to strike to make sure that they got the day off. All U.S. states and districts of Columbia and the United States territories have subsequently made Labor Day a statutory, you are compelled as a employer to give that day off, to pay for your employees' non-productivity so that they can recognize themselves, the common man. Anyway, Labor Day became a federal holiday shortly after the Pullman strike of 1894, killing likely 30 people. But that information has been suppressed. You know, so what they say on Wikipedia is 4 to maybe 30. And I'm leaning on a higher number, and I'm always leaning on a higher number. Why? Because if we acknowledge that Wikipedia, the press, and everybody today does everything they can to tilt information to help glorify, way back then, they were doing everything they could to make sure that they were glorifying collective labor and hiding the reality of collective labor, which is compulsion, coercion, and deadly force. So the one thing I think that's really, really imperative is that, you know, we really stop. We need to start standing up and stopping Labor Day. If we as patriots recognize how this became, and, you know, unions today have actually and slowly have faded out other than government. Government is the only place where you'll still find a high preponderance of unions, such as the teachers, such as, well, medical workers and so forth. They're starting to grow, but in some cases, they're actually losing their presence in that industry. But there's no doubt in my mind that when we're looking at government has basically galvanized union or collective labor, you know, as a part of their work. And let's remember the reason why we were told unions were so critical is because the conditions of the workers were just, you know, horrific. You were working on dirt floors, the conditions were terrible. People were dying because of the conditions the employers were putting these people through. And you know what? That's hyperbole. Not that there wasn't an outlier here or there, but that wasn't the common case. And as a matter of fact, I actually did a study on this. I looked at some studies and I did a report on some studies of this. That's what I should say. That most people don't know that Procter & Gamble, even though they were attacked by the unions, Procter & Gamble did everything they possibly could. They had the best facilities, and they were actually profit-sharing with their employees to keep the unions from being entrenched in Procter & Gamble. But the union laborers didn't care how good those employees had it. They had to, and you got to understand why the union organizations are so coercive, because they're a parasite. They make their money off of, you know, supposedly the workers' back, but they know what they're really doing is they're tapping the employer, placing a tax on the employer so that they can continually grow and grow. It's almost like it is organized crime. And I know there's a lot of union people that hear this and they just don't like to hear this at all. But when you really think about it, my wife had worked in a union hospital as a nurse. And so when she worked there, they took a good sum of money out of her pocket. And when she was working for the exact same employer, but she went into a non-union area, all of a sudden all of her money was coming in. And it's not like she had a pay raise. She didn't even obtain a pay raise at all. But her pay went up a couple hundred dollars each payday. In other words, we're talking about almost $500 the union was tapping out there, $400 or $500. Folks, you can't tell me that's a parasite because they did nothing for her. Many times, every time, you know, she would bring up a problem or a point, and I go, what the heck are you paying the union for? Why are you guys paying the union when you're suffering from these types of problems? And I'm telling you, it's all about corruption, because when you bring money into everything, you will find corruption. Now, I don't have time to necessarily go into the Billy Graham. That's why we're going to do this as a separate day, because that's a good paragraph. And really, the Billy Graham letter is a letter that was written by a hardcore commie, or a kid that went on a, I think it was like an internship out of North Carolina down to Mexico. And while he was down there, he was basically converted to communism. And he dedicated the rest of his life to communism, ideological. And so what Mr. Goldberg talks about that I wanted to bring up, because folks, you really need to understand how problematic this really is, how collectivism, statism, it's all problematic. And I'm one that actually is totally anti-statism. I do not believe that the state should dictate the labor or anything like that. But when I say the state, I mean the federal government. I believe that if you look at your state, if there are services that are absolutely required. So let's just say competitive nature is what causes a free market. You have to have competition. You have to have the ability of competition. How much ability do you have in competing for roadways? Now, do you have the ability to create your own road system so you can get to point A to point B without, you know, having to make your own road? Technically, you actually have to cut through other people's property. All that property has to be done, and you have to pay for that. Theoretically, it is unrealistic for anybody to create their own road or any company to come in. And this is why these companies that create these fast tracks is basically a parasitical organization that comes in and actually starts bilking the people for more money, and they split that money with government. So it's another way government makes more money off of you, getting you to think, oh, well, we can help you that's willing to pay. You know what? If everybody did a class action lawsuit, because, and there's a way to do this, and I could go down that, but I don't want to dive into this for the whole show. If everybody did a class action lawsuit against all of these toll roads, because bottom line, the taxpayers paid for those, for the initial establishments of these roads. And so if everybody sued and said, hey, you're actually taking something we paid for and giving somebody the ability to create an advantage for people who are willing to pay, you can't do that. And it'll come right out that they can't. But it really requires the people to take a stand. And so the best way to do this, folks, is stop, you know, all these fast tracks, all these toll roads and so forth. Just go through. Now, when you go to the turnpikes on the East Coast, when they actually have gates and toll keepers and so forth, that, you know, that's a little bit different because they actually have physical control. But if there are roadways that are, you know, open and it's all honor and they have these little, you know, transponders and so forth, folks, everybody get in there. Everybody clog those lanes as well. They have them in Seattle. They have them in L.A. They have them all over in the west side of this nation. They don't have physical controls over these things. And so prove to the state that there's nothing they can do. They basically, you know, prove to them that we've actually figured out this scam and that all roadways that the taxpayers have actually funded should be open to the taxpayers and not, you know, some elite access to those people who are willing to pay $10 an hour for riding on that road with that transponder or however much they have to pay. So anyway, the strike you really need to look into is the Seattle labor strike of 1919. folks, the police ended up setting up machine gun mounts and so forth. Strikes in the West Coast and collectivism on the West Coast was just out of control. Now, Seattle, or I should say Washington, became a state when? In 1898. I've told people that when you look at the people that were here in America, and oh, by the way, when you go through this labor strike and you read up on this, you're going to actually read that the people were being told, hey, Russia showed us the way. In other words, they were trying to create a Bolshevik revolution right then and there. They just didn't have enough of the hearts of the and minds of the people to actually get away with the Bolshevik revolution. And so they realized that, okay, but that's okay. You know, Union really thought that they could do this. And actually, it proved that they needed one institution to really pull off the full-fledged Bolshevik Revolution to get everybody on board. Now, FDR, through the education system, already started doing that. And the education system itself was already co-opted. They were just not there in 1919. In 1920, guess what they had? They had the Scopes trial. So this was the big barrier of communism in America. All of these things, as they started attacking the school system, getting prayer out of the school and so forth, all of these things were integral in getting your children today to be weaponized in attacking your liberties and attacking your freedoms so that they can surrender to this beautiful god of government. And I'm telling you, folks, they're all being primed. These are the days, and when I tell you it's either now or never, we're living in the time of now or never. So not sure what it's going to take, but the one motto that they have, the ends justify the means. That is the standing, I'll just say, cry of the communist. Now, since I have a little bit of time left, there's probably a few things that I could get into and so forth. And because the trading markets are closed and we're only looking at the futures, I think one of the things that would be, you know, beneficial is let's talk about the digital currency and the effect of the market on the digital currency. Because, let me see here, where's the last time I put it? Is it here? Is it here? There we go. So gold was 1814 on March 7th. I'm going to continue doing this so that you can watch how this has been affected. Now, the last time I talked about this, it was 1895. So in other words, it got down to almost 18, and it was in the 1800s again. Gold is now 1943. So in the past week or two, it's jumped up about $50. Silver was down to, it was 2007. A couple of weeks ago, it was 2283. Now it's 2429. So it's, you know, it's riding back up again. So my point is that we saw a spike. We saw a lot of people go into the market because they realized that they needed gold and silver. Even though FedNow went live and most people said, okay, you know, as this goes live, and even I thought that more and more people would really see the threat of the digital currency. Why is it that so few people have really saw this? And so why is it that yours truly was a little bit wrong in the deduction here? Well, actually, my biggest mistake, and I think everybody's biggest mistake, is how many people are embracing cryptocurrency? How many patriots are all behind cryptocurrency? A lot of them. As a matter of fact, Kristi Noem of South Dakota vetoed the digital currency bill because it didn't include cryptocurrency. Instead of actually saying, you know, all of these currencies are contradictory to the U.S. Constitution, so we can't have them. They're unacceptable. We actually need to go down a different path. But instead, no, she didn't do that. You know, she didn't actually say, no, this is a huge violation and I veto this and a permanent veto. Most everybody was just going, what? Okay, so instead of, and as a matter of fact, South Dakota, instead of amending the bill and including cryptocurrency, they just, with their arrogant self, the leadership. Now here, so this is how out of tune the leadership was in South Dakota. They could have got this bill passed, possibly, by teaching people that, oh, well, we're gonna include cryptocurrency. The real reason why that bill did not pass is because of the First Amendment petition that was slapping most all of those who had a conscience on the rear side. We had a petition that basically called them out and was demanding their removal from office for violating their oath. See, in South Dakota, they actually have it in the state constitution that if you falsely take an oath or you violate your oath, then you can no longer be in office. And if you actually commit an act of commission, in other words, you vote for something that can be proven a violation, like we did, was a violation of the Constitution, man, there's no hope for you. I mean, there's no defense, I should say. But had it been an act of commission, something that they didn't know, or something that wasn't, you can't really prove, oh, well then, okay, there you go. Is there anything in the Constitution about water rights? So there's obviously something about currency in the Constitution, so they can't touch any bills that way. But they are touching the water rights. They are touching all sorts of things that they don't even have the constitutional power for. And it's not in their Constitution. It's not in the state Constitution, I should say, and it's not in the U.S. Constitution. Oh, well, then that's an act of omission. Not commission. In other words, well, it's not there, but who says we can't do it? Well, actually, if you understand the Constitution, you can't do it, but that gets harder to prove. It's harder to actually get people to become agreeable that we actually have enumerated constitutions, that the people, some of these state constitutions fail to actually mention that only these things delegated are left for the state to execute, and all things not delegated are reserved to the people. They don't have that kind of clause. At least a lot of states I don't see have that clause. So even though there's no general powers within these constitutions, everybody has just granted themselves general powers. And this is the rub. This is the real dangerous rub that we're facing. So one of the things I really need to probably dive into as well is republicanism. So I'm going to kind of fit that in. But as we get ready, because I just, now that it's September, well, what's coming up, folks? What is really important that you need to know that's coming up? Well, the Constitution. So between now and, let me see, that we've got basically 2 weeks to cover these next few topics, because we've already covered the Assumption Act. And when Paul and I meet tomorrow, we're going to cover the cod fishery bounties. We're also going to then cover Madison's essay on property. That's a kind of just a short read, but we'll cover that. And then we'll dive into the Whiskey Rebellions. And then we're going to talk about the 11th Amendment and the Convention of States at that point. Then we will talk about the 1798 resolutions, and probably at that point we will then be covering the Constitution. If not, then we can go into the 12th Amendment, and then there's all sorts of these other little things like state enabling acts, the Missouri Compromise, the Monroe Doctrine, the Manifest Destiny, the clarification on the doctrine of nullification. And then we can go through the vetoes of the Department of Transportation, Madison's letter to John G. Jackson. All of these are source documents that we really want to go through, or analysis documents that I've created that I believe really help lay out the argument of how these powers don't exist, how we actually have to go down this path of, holding government accountable, or actually going after them and saying, hey, you need to actually step up and do this, or basically initiate. That's the whole point behind these petitions. So with a little over 3 minutes left, Let me kind of circle back around regarding the importance of how petitions are critical. I know I say this every time, and since today we have the highest listenership, you know, that we have throughout the month, because everybody else is running reruns. Everybody else is, you know, playing the best of, and this is actually live content. So the petition is the weapon of choice. It is absolutely the constitutional weapon that has been given to us, we the people, to actually have the ability to hold our public servants and our government accountable. The concept of the petition is literally the same thing as you basically balling your fist and punching a politician, metaphorically punching your politician right between the eyes in a public forum. Because what you're doing is you're telling that public servant or a group of public servants like your county commissioners or your board of supervisors, you're telling them that the Constitution is being violated and you're doing nothing about it. And in some cases, you're telling them that your state legislators are directly violating the Constitution and you're doing nothing about it. This is a direct assault upon their honor and integrity because they took an oath to office. And this is a direct assault on, you know, their standing in being qualified as an eligible of being a public servant. Because we go through this whole argument within the petition of what the Constitution says, what these scoundrels should be doing, and why they're, you know, what they have to do to fix this. And because you have actually taken an oath, it is your job to actually hold them accountable. So the intent is, and this is what a good county commissioner, a good supervisor, they're not, as a matter of fact, they don't have to get everybody to agree. All you need is one county commissioner to endorse this. And now you've just created a division right there within the county commission. And so if you have if you've got known bad players and you have one good player in your county commission, this is how you can help him, because now he has or she has, you know, petitions that they're going to endorse, and they don't even have to drive. They don't have to drive, but the best way to do this is, you know, they actually take a trip and they hand these things over in their next trip. But what they can do is they can create a cover letter and they can forward these petitions and basically say, you really need to do this. You are violating and fully endorsing the language of these petitions to the governor, to all of the state officers, or whomever this is directed to, and always will include the state legislature, I mean. Bottom line, folks, we have a petition. You better get it ready and you better start getting this moving regarding the COVID shutdowns of 2023. They're already talking about, you know, calling for shutdowns, and your state, if they didn't do it last time, there's a good likelihood they'll do it this time, because Biden is now in office. And last time it was Trump that was in office, and he made it basically, you know, voluntary. You know, they just recommended that we flatten the curve or what have you. He didn't compel the states to do it. Biden will. And now is the time to start actually taking the stand so that in the next election, we can start separating the wheat from the chaff. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. And let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.